a couple of announcements. The first one, and Hannah, don't go crazy. We're not going to have lab this afternoon. I mentioned this earlier, and some people went, they were a little bit over exuberant, I think, about that. So don't act too happy about it. The weather is not supposed to be very good this afternoon, and I've got some things that come up I have to take care of. So we'll just think of it as the afternoon off, okay? And then the homework assignment is due today, and you can turn it in really any time. It looks like most of you already done it, but if you're not quite finished up, you can just slip it under my door, email it to me, whatever is easiest. Okay? And I've got the tests graded, and I'll give them back to you at the end of class. And by and large, and there's a range, as there usually is, I think somebody got 48 out of 50, so that probably was the high score, and I think someone got about 25 out of 50, so gives you an idea of the range there. And what I would suggest about it is look it over and give it back, and if you don't understand why you miss things, or you feel like you're not understanding the material, then I encourage you, come by and we can talk about it a little bit, because if you feel like you're missing things, then that's something that it's better to deal with sooner rather than later. And I guess maybe on a more positive note, we do drop the lowest test score. So, if you didn't do as well as you want on that, maybe you can think of it in terms of this will be the one that you drop. Yeah?
So would lab time today be a good time to come to your office? No,
because I won't be there. But if you want to pick a time, just email me and we can find some time. I'll be around. I have office hours for Soil 205 on Monday, Wednesdays, and Fridays, so you can almost always find me then in the mornings. Okay? So on Tuesday, we got started talking about weathering, and this idea that you've got these minerals that form under high pressure and high temperature. You put them in the environment like they are in a soil at the Earth's surface, and they're just not very happy. That's happiness is kind of in a thermodynamic sense, but they tend to alter. And we call this alteration weathering, and it's probably one of the more important transformations that goes on in soils. And you might remember, maybe from intro soils, that there's actually two types of weathering that we can consider. And one of them is just physical weathering. And that's really nothing more than a change in size. For example, you might have a rock, and because it's sitting out in the sun, it heats up, and then it cools off at night. And over time, the rock might split apart, or part of it may exfoliate and come off. And we haven't really changed anything chemically or mineralogically. All we've done is broken down the size. And that's generally what physical weathering is all about, just a general size reduction in a rock or a mineral. And some of the things that cause physical weathering are freezing and thawing. You might get ablation by sand blowing around, something along those lines. Roots can actually cause rocks to break apart. They can exert quite a bit of pressure, and the heating and cooling, as I mentioned. So a lot of possibilities, but normally, as I said, this is just a change in size, and I guess you might think of it as the first step to the more advanced type of weathering, because if you break down the particle size of something. So imagine you got a rock, size of a softball, and you break that up into little pieces. Mineralogically and chemically, it's still the same, but what have you done? You've changed the amount of surface area. And that kind of leads into the second type of weathering, which is chemical weathering. And chemical weathering is the type of weathering that does involve a change in the chemical or mineralogical composition of something. And we're going to talk a little bit about some of the ways that this occurs, because there's some very common types of weathering reactions. But that's where you actually start to see the formation of new types of weathering products, and we'll talk a little bit more about this. So the I guess the one way to consider this, and I'm going to come back to the images here. This one is number 6 on your sheet. I don't know why the thing is flashing on and off, but let's take a soil profile that is formed in an igneous rock, and for simplicity, this actually is granite. You can see the CR horizon down there, so it's soft, weathered bedrock. And as we move up closer to the surface, we might have something that we would designate as a BW horizon, a weak B horizon. Now, if we could go in and take a very thin slice of soil material out of each of those horizons and look at it under a microscope, this is what it might look like. Down here in the CR horizon, you can see these different colored mineral grains. And again, we're looking at a very thin slice of these things. This right here is a feldspar grain, the grayish with the stripes. That looks like a feldspar grain. These lighter colored ones are probably quartz. This orange one is probably a mica. And you can see that there isn't a whole lot of weathering in this. In other words, these mineral grains are fitting together more or less like the pieces of a puzzle. And this is kind of indicative of maybe a horizon that really hasn't undergone too much chemical weathering, but maybe a little bit more physical weathering, because you remember with the CR designation, that means we can actually dig through this, all right? It's not hard to the point where you'd need dynamite or something to blast it. But not a whole lot of weathering there. Now, if we move up and look at a very thin slice of the BW material, might look like this. You notice that the grains are broken up a lot more. So we're seeing definitely a lot more physical weathering. And these lighter colored ones are generally quartz. The gray are probably feldspars. And you notice how you start to see some bits of yellowish material in there? That is, in most cases, clay material. And it's probably some of the weathering of mica, but as you can see this long piece here. But what you're starting to see is some actual indication of chemical weathering as well, and maybe the formation of secondary weathering products. And when I say secondary weathering products, all that means is that you take a primary mineral like feldspar or a mica, and you chemically weather that, and you're going to get some sort of a new product, okay? And we'll talk a little bit about what some of those are, but this might be the way it would appear if you're looking specifically at the minerals in the soil. And you notice that the more weathering is up at the top of the soil, right? And that's something that is very typical, that as you go from the surface down, the intensity of weathering decreases. So the most weathering is going to be up at the surface, where you get the greatest variation in temperature and probably the most inputs of water and carbon dioxide and biological activity and so on, because all of those can contribute. Well, what I want to do is talk about some of the real basic weathering processes that go on in soils and are responsible for a good deal of the alteration that we see. And one of the common ones, and these are listed in your book and described a little bit, but oxidation and reduction. And this is a very simple example, but this mineral grain you see on the left is hornblende. It's an amphibole, and you might remember that's one of the mafic minerals, meaning that it has a lot of iron and magnesium present in it. Well, a lot of the iron that you find in primary minerals, or the minerals that form as magma cools, generally have iron in the reduced form. Now, if you've got a well-drained or well-aerated environment at the Earth's surface, there's going to be a real strong tendency for that iron to oxidize or form rust, okay? You've all seen that. And it's just a simple, you take iron plus 2, and you can see the oxidation there goes to iron plus 3, so it's losing an electron, right? And then we already talked about the reverse of this, where you add an electron to iron plus 3, or the oxidized form, and you reduce it to iron plus 2. So it is a reversible type of reaction. But what happens as this hornblende mineral starts to weather, because it has a lot of iron, there's a very strong tendency for that iron to oxidize, and you start to get, here's the crystal structure, the hornblende, and you can see all this fuzzy stuff down in there. That's actually iron oxide that is forming as a result of this oxidation process. So we're doing two things. We're breaking down the hornblende mineral, and we're producing, among other things, iron oxide is a weathering product. And you imagine over time, the soil, these iron oxides are going to start to give that soil a reddish color or a brown color, something along those lines. So that's one example of a weathering reaction. And generally, any mineral that contains iron is probably going to be very susceptible to this oxidation reaction. And one way to think about it, it's going to disrupt the crystal structure, and that promotes more weathering and so on. Yeah, question?
Okay. Well, you just kind of answered it. I was just going to say, like, what are you looking for? But you said it's like crystal structure.
Mm-hmm.
And so, like, that's how you can tell there's oxidation going on?
Well, it just, with this is an electron micrograph, and most of these electron microscopes have a way that you can look at a specific thing on there and get some idea of the elemental composition. And it turns out that this stuff down there is mostly iron. So, you know, the assumption would be that it is an iron oxide. I don't know which type in this case. Okay, another type of weathering reaction is just simply solution, or you might think of it as dissolution. And we already talked about this with regard to calcium carbonate. How you take calcium carbonate, which is a solid, and you add water and throw a little CO2 in there to make carbonic acid. And what that does is it solubilizes the calcium carbonate, and you've got the calcium ion and the bicarbonate ion, and those can then move down in the soil to form a BK horizon. But this reaction will also go back the other way. And to some extent, almost all minerals are going to be, they're going to have at least a limited solubility in water. So this is an extremely important reaction, and we've talked about it with regard to BK horizons and calcium carbonate. But even something like, remember SiO2, quartz? Not a very soluble substance at all, but if you take quartz or other types of silica minerals, put them in water, there's going to be a little bit of this formed, this SiO2, it's called silicic acid, and it is a soluble form of silica. Now, if you remember from chemistry, some reactions are very strongly favored. In other words, you know, you might be favored to form this. This does not proceed very rapidly, meaning you can only dissolve just a tiny bit of silica, but this figure out of your book, 4.4, it kind of shows the solubility of silica, and I wouldn't worry about the units. This is millimoles of silica per liter, but it's real low. And you can see over the pH range, until you get up to about 8, then it really shoots up. And also on here is aluminum, which down at low pHs is quite soluble, but then it's practically insoluble here in the pH range of most soils, and then it goes up there. So keep this in mind, that almost anything is going to have at least some solubility in water. Now, remember this feature we looked at before, the BKQM horizon? Given that silica is so relatively insoluble, how do you ever get enough silica to cement a foot or two of subsoil into one of these durapans? How could you envision that happening? Give it really limited solubility. How would you ever get that much silica to cement the subsoil? Okay, one possibility, yeah, high pH. And there is evidence that a lot of these soils with durapans might have been natric soils once upon a time, or sodium affected soils, and those do have high pHs, up around 9. Can you think of another mechanism? What was one of the characteristics we talked about durapans in terms of their age?
They're really old.
They're really old. So imagine you dissolve just a little bit of silica, but you do it over a long, long period of time. And that might help explain the accumulation that you see. And what may be one final possibility, instead of imagining the silica as quartz, it could be something like a volcanic ash, which tends to be a lot more soluble than quartz, so you might get a lot more silica out of that. But yeah, Kat?
So would like an environment with just high sodium do that? You mentioned that, but like a coastal soil, would that have higher silica because it's...
It definitely could because of the, you know, this... But you see where this really starts to, you know, take off. You're getting up in pHs 9 and 10, and that's really unusual in most soil environments. And outside of having a sodium-affected soil, it's just, it's not something you're going to find that often. So anyway, just this simple solution, and remember that most, you know, most minerals, to one degree or another, you can dissolve a little bit in water. Now here's another one. It looks kind of ugly. But don't worry about all the formulas, but I just want to kind of go through the general process. The reaction is called hydrolysis, and maybe this is something you recall from chemistry. What does hydrolysis mean?
Create or make water?
Well, our hydro, water, and then lysis means splitting. So what we're doing is effectively splitting a water molecule, and here's the way to look at it. Here's a feldspar mineral, okay? And in this case, it's albite, and I put the formula up there. And don't worry too much about the formula. I'm not going to ask you to reproduce it for something like this. But notice the components of feldspar: oxygen, silicon, aluminum, some sodium in there. Those were all on that list we put on the board the other day, right? So not too surprising. And then this bicarbonate, or carbonic acid there, that's just simply water and CO2. Then here's a water molecule. Now look on the right side of the equation. What happens is the water molecules get split, and effectively, if you look at the albite there, the sodium that's in there, well, you got this stuff on the right side, and there's no sodium in there. So what's happened is the hydrogen from water has effectively replaced that sodium in the albite. And again, I wouldn't worry about all the details here, but you might recognize that Al2SI2O5OH4, that's one of the formulas that you'll see for kaolinite, which hopefully you've heard the term kaolinite before, and you realize that's one of the clay minerals that is commonly formed in soils, and in some cases maybe a dominant one. So it's through this reaction that we take a primary mineral like a feldspar, and through hydrolysis, it's chemically weathered, and one of the weathering products in this case would be kaolinite, or one of these one-to-one clay minerals that's as I said, probably almost ubiquitous in soils. You'd be hard-pressed to find a soil anywhere that didn't have at least some kaolinite in it. And a lot of the feldspars will weather through this type of reaction, and remember, that's a pretty big group of minerals. There are a lot of different types of feldspars. And here, if you look, you see how this feldspar grain is kind of pitted up and you've got those little yellow areas in it? Well, typically when you're looking at a thin section of soil material like we are here, the yellow indicates clay. And if you could zoom in on that, this is what kaolinite might look like, where it's forming there as a result of hydrolysis. It's this stack of plate-like material. It's what we call a phyllosilicate, and hopefully that rings a bell from intro soils. It looks kind of like the pages in a book, and that's typical of a lot of these clay minerals, the layer silicates that form in soils. Yeah?
Is kaolinite, is that the kind of clay they use to make plates and stuff?
Yeah, it's the what we think of as a not very active clay, and oh, I've got another image of it, but it's the one that is, it doesn't have much shrink swell, it doesn't have a lot of ion exchange capacity, and because of that, if you're making pottery, that would be the preferred one to use, as well as a lot of other products as well. They kaolinite you'll find in just about anything, really. Okay, another reaction they talk about in your book, this is potassium removal from mica. You've all seen sheets of mica. They may look like the upper left-hand corner there. Again, it's sort of like the pages in a book. And the thing about mica is when you find it as a primary mineral, all of these 2-to-1 layers, does everybody remember 2-to-1 layer? You've got two the two refers to the silica tetrahedral sheets, and then that's sandwiched around a sheet of aluminum. And I've got a couple more diagrams. But anyway, all of those, each of the 2-to-1 layers is held together by potassium that sticks in there. And what happens is, over time, you know how mica, being in this sort of the sheet-like structure, these things tend to come apart. And water gets in here, and you get the potassium taken out there. And over time, what happens, you can see in this diagram, the mica starts to come apart, and you end up with a mineral, if you carry this on out, where you get rid of all that potassium, or most of it, you end up with the mineral called vermiculite. Does that ring a bell? Vermiculite? Yeah, it's a 2-to-1 layer silicate. So each one of these things represents one of these 2-to-1 layers. But this would be the type of weathering that would go on in a soil. And we're creating a weathering product, in that case, vermiculite. Okay, so if you think about some of these weathering reactions and how they would proceed, I showed you a relatively unweathered soil when we started this. Well, this is one of the red clay soils from the southeastern United States, and one of the characteristics is they have fairly well-developed BT horizons. And if you look at the thin section of this stuff, it's going to look like this. All of this red and yellow that you see in there, that mix, is a combination of iron oxides and kaolinite clays. So the white that you see are probably a few quartz grains that are in there, and these darker areas and probably going to be pores in most cases. But the point is, you don't see all of these distinct mineral grains like we did in that first example, because most of the weatherable minerals in there, the feldspars and micas and things like that, have weathered. And the weathering products are, as I said, iron oxide, giving it the red color, and the kaolinite clays, which maybe show up here as some of the yellowish material that you can see. So this would represent a much more advanced stage of weathering, where you've taken the original parent material, and it could have been granite in this case, but if you look at the thin section of that soil now, it's pretty difficult to tell that that was once granite because it is so highly altered. Well, this was a figure that's out of another book, but I put it on here because it shows something relative to weathering and what we're talking about. Here are the elements from the elemental composition. They've got an average of igneous rocks, very similar to what we talked about. The percentages may be a little bit different. And then they're showing the content in three different soils. And I guess what I'd like to do is call your attention to this column on the right. This is what's called the Colombiana clay. It's from Costa Rica. Probably an oxisol, or very highly weathered soil. And what do you notice about the elemental composition of this relative to the average of igneous rocks? What has really changed in terms of elemental composition? Well, let's start at the top. What's happened to silica? It's gone down, right? There's a lot less silica over here. How about aluminum? It's gone up. How about iron? It's gone up. And does this ring a bell as far as a process that we talked about a couple weeks ago? Loss of silica and accumulation of aluminum and iron. Yeah, like a BO horizon, and we call that desilication. And this is a good example of it, where this aluminum and iron here, you look at these elemental contents, they are considerably higher than what you probably would have in the parent material. And this is a residual accumulation. In other words, we've lost most of the rest of this stuff, including silica, and as a result, we end up with a high iron and aluminum content. This is another figure that kind of illustrates this. This is on the y-axis here. This is iron plus aluminum relative to silica. So think of it as a ratio. and it's just expressed as a percent. And then this is the age of the soil material. So there's 10 to the third year, 10 to the fifth, 10 to the seventh. And you can see the general trend here is that the amount of iron and aluminum relative to the amount of silica increases over time. And so this is just a way of expressing that desilication process. Loss of silica and residual increase in iron and aluminum. And the other part of this is it shows the clay content, and it's the average clay, or the clay content in the BT horizon. They're also showing color here. And you notice that as the soil, as you increase the amount of clay, they're kind of showing, you might not be able to see this, but they show the hue of the BT horizon. 7.5 YR, 5 YR, 2.5 YR as you get more clay. What's happening to the soil color as more clay is present? It's getting redder, yeah. And part of that is you're increasing the amount of iron there relative to other things, so developing really red color. And so these are all things that would be representative of more highly weathered soils. The redder colors, the relative increase in iron and aluminum relative to silica. And this really is the concept of the BO horizon that we associate with the senile soils, the over-the-hill soils. And if we looked at a thin section of this oxisol here and really zoomed in on it, what we would find is one of the dominant components of this thing is hematite, which you barely see the formula there, Fe2O3, oxidized form of iron, very common iron oxide, and one that gives soils a bright red color. And you can see it looks like little balls of string almost in there, but that's the crystalline structure of it. But a lot of hematite in there would be the one of the dominant minerals. So it's representing one of the weathering products. Some other types of weathering products that are common in soils and worth mentioning, metal humus complexes. You've probably heard this term before. There are a couple of soils that we can certainly associate with these metal humus complexes. And remember we talked about podzolization and the formation of a chelate where you take an organic molecule and then it hooks up with aluminum or iron and moves it. Well, if you look at what I've drawn here, here's an example of an organic chelate. It's the oxalate or oxalic acid. Pretty simple organic compound. The carbons don't show on there, but they would be the position there. So it's organic. And what happens is you take three of those oxalate molecules and you can kind of surround an aluminum ion. And what this makes is an aluminum chelate. And this is soluble. And so it's going to move from the E horizon and then be deposited down here. In this case, it looks like a BHS horizon. And so you would have this BHS horizon kind of dominated by these metal humus complexes. And so I've shown aluminum here. Iron would be the same way. Iron plus 3, you can imagine the exact same type of mechanism. And that would probably be the dominant sort of mineralogy in there, or dominant secondary minerals that you'll find present in that soil horizon.
So in terms of maybe nutrients in the soil, does that change? Usually humus has a lot of fertility. Is that the same when it is chelated?
Well, probably not. And one of the things here is that, well, first of all, in this soil, this E horizon is going to be extremely acidic, which most plants don't like that at all, and it's usually not very good for the availability of a whole range of nutrients. And probably the metal humus complexes, most of them are going to be, in this case, complexes between iron and aluminum and humus. And generally, anytime you start getting aluminum in a system, it's not very good for most plants as well. So I wouldn't think of this as being a very fertile type of soil at all. But you might want to contrast that with this. What would you guess this soil is down here?
Sandy.
lower left-hand corner. It's from a grassland. Yeah, Mollisol. It's got the thick, dark A horizon in it, or A horizons. And if you looked in there, you would also find these metal humus complexes, but they're very, very different. This is a schematic out of a soil chemistry book, and they're calling it a clay humate complex in soil. So this top part is a clay mineral. It could be vermiculite or kaolinite, one of those types of things. And then you've got this big organic molecule. And then in here they show that M symbol. That would be a metal, or probably something like calcium or magnesium. And so this is in a grassland system, a little bit higher pH. But the point here is that you get this really close association between organic material, calcium and magnesium, and some of these other clay minerals. And it would be probably a fairly dominant type of complex that you'd find in a grassland soil. And this would be a lot more fertile than what we're looking at previously, because things like calcium and magnesium, I mean, those are required by plants in pretty large quantities. So if you have a lot of those in the soil, generally speaking, you're going to have a much higher level of fertility. And I guess the other thing about this is, remember, the big difference between soil and geologic material is the fact that you've got organic carbon in soils, right? Through the additions of organic matter and the transformation. So these are things, these metal humus complexes are almost exclusively limited to soils. A few other minerals I want to mention. We always talk about iron and aluminum oxides. Well, the most common aluminum oxide that you get in soils is something known as gibbsite. And you can see the formula there, AlOH3. And on this, the gibbsite, it kind of shows up here in these yellowish flecks. This would be a pretty highly weathered soil. Under a scanning electron microscope, you can see the crystal structure of the gibbsite right there. But certainly the most common aluminum, we'll call it aluminum oxide. It's actually aluminum hydroxide, but we just typically say iron aluminum oxides, and it includes all of these things. But this would be the most common aluminum variety. There are other types of iron oxides. We already mentioned hematite, Fe2O3, and that's what gives soils the red color. The brown colors or yellowish colors that you typically see in a soil, this is another type of iron oxide. It's called goethite or goethite, if you want to use the German pronunciation. And you can see the formula there, FeOOH. It's a little bit different, but it's still oxidized iron, or iron in the +3 state. And if we look at the one of our volcanic ash mantles around here, there's another type of iron oxide known as ferrihydrite. It's got a more complicated formula, you can see down here, but it's still Fe2O3, a variation on that. So it's oxidized iron. This just happens to be a more poorly ordered or more poorly crystalline version of an iron oxide. It's very common in soils that are weathered from volcanic ash. So important around here. Kaolinite, as I said, you'd be hard-pressed to find a soil anywhere in the world that doesn't have at least some kaolinite in it. And kaolinite is what we call a one-to-one layer silicate. You can see the block diagram here. These pyramid shapes represent what? Think back to intro soils. What are these pyramids looking things represent chemically? What kind? Yeah, it's a tetrahedral.
And it's SCO4.
Yeah, it's silicon, which would be in the center of one of these things, and then it's oxygens or OH groups in coordination with it. So you've got silicon in the center, and then those four oxygens that would go with it. These dark blue things are known as octahedrons or octahedra, and they have aluminum in the center, and it's coordinated with six oxygens or OH groups. And you know, so we would call this an aluminum octahedral sheet and a silicon tetrahedral sheet, and together that's a one-to-one layer silicate. And kaolinite is probably the layer silicate that we tend to find more, that it's more abundant in more highly weathered soils. And in simplest terms, the idea here is that you've only, for each one of these sheets of aluminum, you only have one sheet of silica. So they're pretty much in equal proportions. And kaolinite would be, for example, the red clay soils of the southeast I showed you earlier. Kaolinite would be the dominant clay type in that. Yeah?
How well should we understand that layering and like the chemical composition?
Well, this idea of the silica tetrahedral sheets and aluminum octahedral sheets, there are variations on it, but I guess if it's a little bit fuzzy, I'd go back and take a look at the intro soils textbook on it. Because what we're going to see, the next couple are just variations on that. Smectite, probably heard of this. This is the clay mineral that we associate with shrinking and swelling soils, verdisol. So when it dries, it cracks. And when it gets wet, it swells up. And it's an example of a 2-to-1 layer silicate. So I tried to illustrate it there. You've got the two silica tetrahedral sheets that are sandwiched around the aluminum octahedral sheet. And then in between the adjacent ones, you've got all these exchangeable cations. So this is a very active type of silicate clay. And is it any surprise that the dominant ingredients in these things, oxygen, aluminum, silicon? No, because that's what was the top three on our list, right? That had on the board the other day. So smectite, I wouldn't worry about the specifics, but it does have a relatively high CEC, and because of the it doesn't have anything holding these adjacent 2-to-1 layers together, that's why it shrinks and swells so easily. Again, a volcanic ash soil, we get another type of aluminosilicate in there, and it's one that is referred to as allophane. The Microsoft Word will always want to change that to allophone, which I have no idea what that is. But allophane is, you can see the chemical formula there, SiO2, Al2O3, and it's got water incorporated into it. And here's a micrograph of it. It doesn't show up real well, but it's sort of a little spheroidal, little spheres of these things. And it's, again, a poorly ordered type of a mineral. It doesn't have the real good crystal structure that we see with others, but it's what is typically the dominant weathering product as volcanic ash weathers. So if we look at our volcanic ash mantles around here, you would expect to find a lot of allophane in there. And the reddish brown color would be due to I think somebody said it. Ferrihydrite. Yeah, just the type of iron oxide we mentioned earlier. So, and calcium carbonate, we talked a lot about this and it keeps coming up, but you know, the solution dissolution reaction gives rise to the BK horizons or BKM horizons and some of these little secondary accumulations that we find in the subsoil, but a major constituent of any soil that comes from an arid or semi-arid region, one of the dominant weathering products in there. So this kind of goes back to where we started, and that is this concept of soils being clay factories. So you think about all of these minerals, whatever parent material you start out with, over time what's going to happen is things are going to keep breaking down physically and chemically, and you're going to end up with clays, and they can be the layer silicate clays, they can be things like iron oxides, aluminum oxides, those types of products. But you know, given time, that's where everything is going to go. So think about this. Next time you're driving through the Badlands and you see all these exposures of sedimentary materials, you know, all of that stuff probably weathered in a soil environment, and then it was redeposited, and it'll be parent material once again. But you just keep projecting this over and over, and someday we're not going to have much in the way of primary minerals left. It'll all be clays, just like this guy's telling his kid. Any questions about this? Well, I guess what I would ask that you kind of focus on with this is just to think about these elements that we've talked about, you know, with aluminum, silicon, calcium, magnesium, these types of things, because they're really the building blocks of all of the stuff that we're talking about. And I guess maybe in terms of the picture, just think about in terms of time and weathering, that any soil will start off at time zero. And if you've got granite as a parent material, you're going to have a bunch of what in that parent material in terms of minerals? What would be dominant?
Quartz.
Feldspar. Maybe some mica, biotite, probably hornblende or some other type of amphibole. And almost immediately, as if that granite is at the soil surface and it's going to start to weather. And things like quartz are going to weather very slowly, but some of the feldspars are going to weather very quickly. The iron-containing and magnesium-containing minerals like the hornblende and biotite are probably going to weather pretty quickly. And eventually, you're going to end up with a soil that has some combination of those primary minerals and secondary minerals, or the weathering products that have formed and started to accumulate. And the types of secondary minerals or weathering products that accumulate are going to be very dependent on the type of weathering environment you have. You know, it's going to be very different up on Moscow Mountain than it would be in the southeastern United States. But anyway, over time, if we have a soil up on Moscow Mountain that's formed in granite, if we can project that, a couple hundred thousand years into the future, and you go back and look at it, well, there's probably still going to be a little quartz in there. Are you going to find any feldspar in it? Probably not. All that feldspar is going to be gone, and we should see some type of a clay that has formed, probably kaolinite, something along those lines. We'll probably have iron oxides in there, and probably some aluminum oxides or gibbsite would be in there as well. So the point is, it's going to look very different than that soil did at time zero when it was essentially granite rock. Okay? And it's all these different types of weathering processes going on. All right, I'm going to stop there. And next time, I think a couple more things might finish up with weathering, but we're going to move on to the next unit, which is the U.S. Soil Classification System. And really, we're going to talk a couple weeks about how the classification system is set up, and a little bit about how it came into being, and then how it's put together. And from there on out, the rest of the semester is just going to be using that kind of information to infer information about soils and specific properties.